Welcome to the JPGM Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
It's the June edition of SPGAN's Journal Club. Jake Mann is here, and we have a mystery guest to be announced a little bit later. Jake has picked out two articles that are relevant and interesting and fun to think about, one of which is from JPGN, and we're going to start with that. Biomarkers predicting the effect of anti-TNF treatment in pediatric and adult inflammatory bowel disease. First author is Dwight Winter. The senior author is Johanna Escher, whom we learned earlier today is actually named Hanke. It's nice to have you here, Jake. And why did you pick this article?
Delighted to be here. So I think that this article's interesting because it tackles a clinical problem that we see in probably the vast majority of our pediatric IBD patients, such that they start out with the ideal plan of going along their protocol of infliximab, and then at some point we end up increasing the dose or we reduce the duration. So this is a high-quality cohort because they have a prospective observational study, and then they've tried to look and understand why are some of those patients having dose escalation.
Dose escalation, now, antibodies don't play a role in this, or?
Well, that would be certainly one question, and the theory would be that the patients who have antibodies or that are ending up with low infliximab levels and then they simply do not have sufficient therapeutic level within their blood to facilitate its action. But one of the interesting observations is that there was no association, at least in this cohort, between dose escalation, either frequency or absolute dose per infusion, and infliximab levels.
So it's not a matter of underdosing or of decreased bioavailability of the agent, at least so far as we can tell. Well, what clues to mechanism do the biomarkers that they purport to have discovered give us insights into?
Well, I suppose if it's not a lack of bioavailability, then the theory would be that there is either something inherently different about those patients or there's something different about their disease. And probably like many chronic diseases, we at the moment label it in a relatively crude way, but in fact, it probably exists in many different subtypes. And we're giving what is a very effective treatment, but it is a blanket one-size-fits-all treatment. However, they didn't notice really any statistically significant associations between our standard panel of biomarkers, CRP, white cells, or other clinical parameters, and the treatment failure or the need to escalate doses. So then they went on to do these proteomic study.
And what did they find?
So there's several ways you can do proteomics. And here they've done plasma proteomics from baseline. So this is pre-initiation of infliximab treatment. And they've used one of the standard panels, the Olink panel, but they've not done their kind of full panel that's available, which is about 4,000 or 5,000 proteins. This was a targeted panel of 91 serum proteins. And it wasn't in their whole cohort of study, which was about 45 patients. They selected five who'd had the need for treatment escalation and 10 who didn't have need for treatment escalation. So we're talking about a selected group of plasma proteins in a selected group of patients. So we do need to factor that in to the results they found. Then they've essentially identified a number of proteins that are all involved in general inflammatory pathways, mostly innate immunity, that are subtly higher in the patients who needed dose escalation. I have a few thoughts about the degree to which we have confidence that these are true results.
And you're going to share those thoughts?
Yes. On the basis that I don't think that the authors have adjusted for multiple tests in the plasma proteomics. So most of the p-values are relatively subtle in the sense that most of them are in the range of 0.01 of that elk. And the if you were to do, for example, a Bonferroni correction, then you really should be looking at more like 0.00, probably 0.01 to have a degree of statistical significance. I think that they're probably quite underpowered here to reliably identify changes. I think that if you're going to do a plasma proteomics study like this, you could take a small number of patients if it was 5 and 10. If you're comparing IBD to no IBD and you're expecting to see massive differences. But if you're looking for subtle differences, you need either a much bigger cohort or you would need to do test only a few targeted proteins, and then you wouldn't have the problems of test lots of p-values being generated.
I take your point. And so this is not a definitive paper, but rather a plea for increased funding.
I really like the concept, and I think that I would love to see more PGAN research moving towards doing unbiased omics-type studies, and this is the way that we should move. I just feel that the power involved and perhaps the methodology may mean that these specific findings may not necessarily be replicated in future.
Gotcha. Well, chafing at the bit, as the phrase goes, to participate in the discussion here is our mystery guest, Professor Benita Kamath. Professor Kamath is based at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. That's a new one for her. Well, it's not a new one. You came from there. You went, and no one is ever a prophet in her own country, so you went up to Canada, became a prophet, and came right back. And we're going to be speaking with her about a piece of work in which she is, well, the verb could be implicated, the verb could be...
leading?
Well, Jake. But a novel model to study mechanisms of cholestasis in human cholangiocytes reveals a role for the SIPR2 pathway. She is the senior author on this article. And I have to admit, I had not heard about SIPR2, and I'd like her to tell us what it is when it's at home.
Hi, Jake and Alex. Thank you so much for having me. I'll step back a little bit first and just tell you why I think this body of work or this field is important. I'm basically fascinated by how bile acids are necessary for health, that they become a problem in disease, and that they can be therapeutic agents. And I think that's the fundamental point of this type of work is bile acids are the most important molecules, but that they're needed in all of these three phases, right? So what we were trying to do in this paper was to explore the reactive cholangiocyte phenotype in a human model. So quite a lot of work has been done in rat cholangiocytes, creating the reactive cholangiocyte phenotype. And that's a phenotype in which cholangiocytes get activated due to a variety of stimuli and then release a whole bunch of pro-inflammatory cytokines and recruit pro-fibrotic cells. So it's almost like a common result of different cholangiopathies and cholestatic diseases.
This is becoming more comprehensible the more I listen. Okay.
Right. So I think that's why we need to think about it and have a humanized model. And that's what we sought to do here was to try to think about what that micro environment looks like in cholangiocytes when they get activated by bile acids, hydrophobic bile acids, and how they react, and then what therapeutic mechanisms could be doing in this system.
How did you go about identifying candidates for participation in this mechanistic?
Oh, right. That was a review of the literature, and SIPR2 seemed to be less well studied, more recently identified in a mouse model, and we wanted to do something a little different. I think a general philosophy in research is if you try and pick something that's relatively understudied, you might discover something new. And so we wanted to, there are so many transporters that bile acids mediate. And I think this one's been relatively understudied. And I think if you look at the data, we saw that it seems to be active when the reactive cholangiocyte phenotype is activated. But also, more importantly, if you take bile acid therapies, urso deoxycholic acid and norurso, they seem to be partially acting through SIPR2 as well. Not wholly, but partially. So it makes you think of other ways that we could augment therapies in addition to urso and norurso.
Jake, you're over there bump on a log, playing Quaker meeting. Ask some questions.
So I think this is a really interesting piece of work because, as Professor Kamath says, that it is so helpful to have a human model to work on these cells. And it's such a fundamental problem to a whole range of disorders in pediatric hepatology. I also quite like the way that the treatment of the cholangiocyte organoids with either the bile acids or TNF seems to model the senescent component of the ductal reaction, because my memory of the literature is that in animal models, they seem to model the proliferative aspect probably more so than the senescent. Is that your view of things?
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that this gives another element really to it. Is there any way that if you were able to, or have you tried manipulating the organoids in a different way to make them proliferate?
Well, we did look at the Ki67 staining, and so we did look at some simple proliferative markers. I think we probably need to do that a little bit more. The other thing I will point out is that in this model, we used single bile acids. So the one that we went with as the most useful injury model was taurocholic acid with TNF-alpha co-stimulation. But of course, if I want to mimic true microenvironment, what we're going to need to start doing is combining bile acids. And that's what we're working on right now. I really want to mimic what cholestasis does in the liver to the cholangiocyte. And so I'll be interested to see where the balance between proliferation and senescence happens when we start combining some of the even more hydrophobic bile acids with taurocholic acid.
Now, I want to ask now, you've been very stumm, very quiet about your work using this model in cholangiocytes that have an inherent defect, maybe something like a JAG1 mutation.
Wow, how did you know?
So it came to me in a dream.
So actually, interestingly, we in the lab are not so much focusing on JAG1 deficient cells. We are actually quite interested at the moment in PKD1L1. You may, of course, know that this has been recently identified as a disease, potential disease gene in biliary atresia. And Saul Carpen has a mouse model. And we are interrogating PKD1L1 in this type of system.
But why do you other cholangiopathies are also ciliopathies. What are you going to be comparing? Are you going to be comparing some of those genes as well?
Well, due to limited resources, we have to pick one gene at a time.
More funding, please.
Okay. Yes. That's the constant cry. So what we're doing is we're knocking down PKD1L1 in an iPSC-derived cell system, and we're differentiating them into cholangiocytes. We'd published a differentiation protocol a few years ago, and we're working with that. This particular study that we're talking about uses echoes, which are primary cholangiocyte cells. So different models can give you slightly different answers. So I think that they're both important to use. The echoes are very easy to use in the cell. We get them from Professor Fotis Sampatiosis from Cambridge, who very kindly has given them to us. You can passage them multiple times. They're quite robust cells. iPSC-derived cholangiocytes take 30 days to make at a minimum and are quite vulnerable. So I think if there's a young researcher out there, you've always got to think about what's feasible and what's easy to handle in the lab. I think that's just a general message. But sorry, I digress. We are at the moment focusing on PKD1L1, and are knocking it out in an iPSC line. We will differentiate those cholangiocytes. And then we could also think about methods to knock down PKD1L1 in echoes as well. That's another potential strategy. But as you said, more funding. If I had more funding, I could do more of this and then think about other genes too.
I think this is highlighting one of the interesting trade-offs in any cellular model. Nothing is perfect, but these echo organoids grow and work and seem to replicate one of the phenomenons that we observe clinically and pathologically. The caveat is that it's harder potentially to genetically manipulate them once they're in situ. And there is also the argument that the extrahepatic bile duct may not necessarily be exactly the same as the intrahepatic bile duct. In fact, we're probably quite sure of that. But this is a good model to take forward, at least the data seems to show at the moment.
I think you're quite right, Jake. And, you know, I think about even perhaps the other limitation of this model is that you're looking at a single cell model, and that's not what's in the liver. So, of course, there have been efforts by other groups. I can think of Georgie Bezea's group, who are growing biliary organoids from liver tissue, and they're more likely to have multicellularity. And so every model, as you point out, has its limitations. But I like the idea of sometimes taking low-hanging fruit and answering some simple questions, and then trying from there to build off to the more complex.
Yeah, you picked up on one of the things I thought would be important to think about is just that this is a single cell model. And I wondered whether it was possible to do a kind of special layered plate or some kind of transmigration assay where you have immune cells covered by a membrane and then the organoids on top. Is that physically possible?
We certainly haven't done it. I've seen some work from, you know, more people with an engineering background who are trying to do that, lining, glass chambers with different cells and then separating them, just as you suggest. That's certainly one way. Or, like I said, just to actually grow more complex organoids, trade off with each of those. I mean, and getting liver tissue, particularly from children, to make organoids also has some limitations there as well.
And my other question really from a therapeutic perspective is, how far off do you think we are from being able to use or try nor deoxycholic acid in children?
Oh, I would love to write that protocol yesterday. So it's really just a question of me currently being based in North America, and there doesn't seem to be a particular appetite for bringing Norasso to North America, but I would absolutely like to try it. I would particularly like to think of Norasso for PSC, which I would say is probably our biggest unmet need in hepatology in general, not just pediatric hepatology.
So we've identified a niche for you, Jane.
Thank you.
Sometimes write that protocol and up, onward and upward. Onward and upward and endward, I'm afraid to say. We're running out of time. But Professor Kamak, thank you so much again for being with us today. Jake, well done you, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.